This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, as always, Shane Told. So great to have you. I hope your new year is going swimmingly. Mine has been terrific. As you guys may have known, if you tuned in last week, I am on my New Year's resolution kick, which is to lose some LBs. And I've let myself go a little bit. It's okay. I'm open about talking about it. So this past week, I've really been hitting the dieting really, really hard. Been eating a lot of salads, been making my own homemade soups and stuff. And so far, the scale actually hasn't moved. It actually says the same number as it did last Monday. But apparently, I don't know, my fitness expert friends are telling me that's okay and whatever and just keep it up. So I'm not discouraged. I'm going to keep it up. I hope you guys, if you guys set New Year's resolutions, you haven't broken them already. As always, I like to hear your New Year's resolutions. I like to be with you on it. So as always, you can get in touch with me. Twitter, Lead Singer Sin. I'm on Snapchat, which is Real Shane Told. And of course, we got old-fashioned email, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. Now, this week's episode, it's a good one. I'm just going to put that right out there. It is a great show. I speak to Davey Muse of Vanna, and this guy has had a really, really crazy life. And typically, I don't like to give too much background, but this one, I feel like I have to. So basically, Davey, when he was 8 months old, was found after an ATF or FBI raid of his parents, who were the biggest drug dealers on the East Coast in Boston. And after they were arrested, the police went back and they found Davey in a drawer, left for dead. It's fucking crazy. And so obviously after that, he went into foster care. And then as a child, you know, his parents had a divorce. And then later in his life, he had a child with a woman that he loved. And he raised that child for 2 months before finding out it wasn't his child. And that led him to a pretty dark place. And music has pulled him out. Music has saved Davey. And now he's giving back by speaking at schools. And that's really cool. He's going to different high schools all over America, and he's speaking about his life and really just providing hope and encouragement for students. And it's really, really awesome. He's amazing. And this conversation is definitely one of my favorites. Before we get into that, I've got to tell you about the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. It is so rad. I am just enjoying it so much. We have a great group of people there on the Facebook. Shout out to everybody who's already signed up. You guys are killing it. Now, to everybody else listening to this who are not members, check it out. For as little as $6 a month, you get bonus episodes. You get a Q&A with me every month. You get to interact with me and the other fans of the show on the Facebook page. For a few bucks more than that, I have stuff I'm actually shipping out to everybody this Monday, which is today, which includes a handwritten note from me, a button, a sticker, some tokens of my appreciation. And the longer you're a member, the more stuff you get, including patches and all that good stuff. And if you want Lead Singer Syndrome merchandise, you got to be a member of the All Access Club to get it. And that's coming super soon, too. So check it out. It's leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. So go have a look. You know, people are always asking me, how do I support the show? How do I support the show? Well, I did this for a year and I didn't ask for much. Now I'm saying, hey, you guys want to support me? Here it is. Here's the club. And you're going to get more and more stuff every month. And so far, everybody on there is really enjoying it. So thank you so much. Anyways, let's jump in. Here's my conversation with an amazing guy, Mr. Davey Muse of Vanna. Oh yeah, there you go. Weird. It's just my I bought like a shitty cable at Radio Shack and it broke.
Oh, that's what you get for getting shitty cables at Radio Shack.
And you know what's funny? I've used it for like the last like 6 months and I know it's been bad, but I just like it's just one of those things, like, you know.
Yeah, you just never place it anyways. It's like you just will continue to tape iPhone charger until it absolutely doesn't work anymore.
Exactly. And then you panic, like, oh my God, I can't believe my life sucks so much. Like, oh, shit always happens to me. And it's like, well, yeah, it always happens to you because you aren't planning ahead, dude.
Exactly.
Hey, man, it's really good to talk to you. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, man. I'm actually currently in my office working. It's no one's here today, so it's peaceful. And I got coffee going, and I'm here with you, man, so I'm good.
Dude, I got a coffee right here. It's so good. Oh, man.
I love
it. Dude, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, my friend. How was your holidays?
Great, actually. Great. Really kind of different kind of holidays, because I had Christmas at my parents' house in, you know, Toronto area. And my sister, who lives in Vegas, brought her husband and her three kids, my three nephews. And they're like right at the age where like Christmas is like, you know, the moon and the stars. It's like everything, you know?
Yeah, and, it's the ultimate.
But then what was kind of crazy was on the 26th in the morning, I actually went on a tour, a solo tour, and I did five shows. You know, kind of like I did a little circle between Detroit and New York City. And yeah, I did five solo shows and I was home back at my house for New Year's Eve.
That's great.
So it's been a whirlwind for me. But yeah, and then New Year's Eve I got home and my friends like went to a cottage like 3 hours north and I was like, nah, I can't, I can't do it. I just can't do it. So I sat on my parents' couch and watched, the Dick Clark, you know, whatever.
The Carson Daly. Drop, yeah.
I watched that with my parents, saw the Mariah Carey debacle and,
what happened to Mariah Carey? I'm hearing things.
Oh, you know. It was hard to watch, man. I as a performer, you know, as somebody that, you know, I know not only do you sing in front of people, you speak in front of people, but
yeah,
dude, it's like every nightmare you've ever had about performing, like coming true. Like, and you know what the thing is I don't know what her backing track situation was, what she's like, what they make you do on New Year's. There's obviously a lot of fake stuff going on, But it seemed like her in-ears just didn't work because she pulled her in-ears out. And then everyone was talking about lip syncing. Well, the first song she did, there was like, it was just, there was no vocals. And she was just like standing around being like, yep,
God,
like this sucks. I don't know what to do. And the only thing that they dubbed in was like the, you know, when Mariah Carey does that like crazy, like I can't even falsetto in the morning, but like like, I don't even know what you call that.
Yeah.
Like, those were obviously.
It sounds like fairy singing.
Exactly, yeah. They had put that in the track. So those came out, you know.
God. Which,
yeah, but then, I don't know. Then it got even weirder because they, like, put a second song. I don't know why they didn't, like, after the first song.
Just broke, immediately bail.
They should have bailed. I know it's New Year's, but man. So, yeah, it's very uncomfortable. It's worth watching, I guess, but you're going to, like, just feel terrible.
I'm going to cringe.
Oh, yeah, it's so cringeworthy. If anyone else listening to this hasn't seen it, it's worth a view. And I like, a lot of people, it sucks because, like, this is lead singer syndrome. I've addressed backing tracks and stuff before on the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because a lot of bands use them. I highly doubt Vanna uses them.
No.
But there are bands in our scene that use them, and the high-ups that are doing these TV shows and everything, almost all of them are using them. And but people are saying, oh, she's lip syncing. And it's like, well, I don't really like know if she even was for that first song. And it wasn't really her fault. You know, she just got caught, you know, probably doing even maybe less, you know, lip syncing or using backing tracks, whatever you want to call it, than the other people that performed earlier in the night. She just happened to get
caught.
Yeah, she got caught because a technical problem.
Some tech somewhere got fired that night.
Oh, 100% somebody did. Although, you know what? Actually, I put it up on my Twitter. It's probably, I'll pin it so people can find it. The Mariah Carey's people made a statement basically about it being the people, the House Audio's people, like from the venue, who they had outsourced because they couldn't use their own people because it's like a bigger production.
Right.
And that they were like, no, don't worry, the in-ears are going to be fine. And she's like, 5 minutes before, she's like, I have static in my ears. Like, and they're like, don't worry, when we go live, it'll be fine.
Oh, so
I don't even know if they can even fire those people because I don't even think they even work for her.
That's true. They can't. Also, I love Mariah Carey's people release a statement. I want people to stop asking me questions and just have my people release statements from now on. I think that's what I have to first find people. I got to find people. And then after I find people, I'm just going to have them like call my mom on the phone and be like, you know, David wants to know if you'd like to go to dinner with him next Tuesday. Please respond to us for an answer. And we will email him and we'll link up. Like, I just, no more human contact for me. Just go through my people.
Yeah, no, that's funny. I forget what it was one time. I was like drunk at a bar and it was like this like little shitty like hole in the wall kind of bar in my hometown. And like we used to go, like me and my friends used to go because there was like nobody there. You know, so it was like kind of just fun to go hang out and there'd be like maybe a couple other people, usually just us in this bar. And I was talking to the owner and he's like obviously struggling a little bit with no one going to his bar.
Sure.
So my friends are all like, oh yeah, dude, Shane, you should come play, man. You should come play. And the guy's like, yeah, like, look, how much would it cost to book? So I said something like, oh, well, I'll have to talk to, like, you know, my agent.
Just
I just naturally said it.
Yes.
It's something I would just say, you know, just say to like anyone that was like, hey, I want to book you, man. Right. Here's my agent's email address. Email him, you know?
Yeah. His name's Dave. Like, he's a great guy.
You're right, right. And the borrower's like, oh, yeah, my agent, big fucking rock star over here. And I'm like, oh, geez, I just can't win, man.
No, yeah. It's always funny even saying that, like, because with speaking at schools, I have an agent who's phenomenal. And he's really passionate about like what he does. And it's so funny because when people are like, oh yeah, I want to have you come speak. I'm like, yeah, yeah, I'll link you with my agent. And they're like, I have to have an agent to speak to you. And I'm like, no, it's just if you want to, God, never mind. I'm a douche. Don't even worry about it. Who cares?
No, it's weird. And you know what else? Like, I guess, you know, we should get into all of the stuff you're doing right now because it's really incredible. My first question, I'm going to go a little bit the either way and throw you a little bit of a curveball.
I'm ready for it.
And you're probably a Red Sox fan, so yeah, so whatever.
Yeah.
but how is that whole dynamic of going into a school, talking to kids, trying to basically, you know, give these kids hope and give these kids a future and do all these positive things, but at the end of the day be like, yeah, I need to get paid too. Like,
yeah,
that must be a super, super weird part of it.
It's an interesting kind of dynamic. When I first started doing it, first and foremost, I never even wanted to, like, you know, speak at schools. I never thought that, like, you know, because when you think of someone that comes to your school and speaks, you think of a guy and he's probably got like what he thinks is a nice suit on, and he comes with PowerPoint and tells you like the secret to success, and like, and then he's selling his book or whatever, you know, like whatever kind of stuff you had in high school. You know, assemblies were never really cool when I was a kid. And
I had a couple fucked up ones in my high school, actually. I'll tell you about them later, but continue.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I did too. I had like hypnotists and weird, you know.
Oh, yeah, I had a hypnotist too.
They were trying stuff in the late 90s. You know, I never really wanted to speak, and I kind of like, you know, I have an interesting story of, you know, growing up, and then, you know, after, you know, the early years, I guess my I had a pretty, you know, typical upbringing, but then, you know, just kind of going through the stuff that I went through in my early 20s and everything is something that I feel like to personally grow a few years ago, I needed to start sharing because it was something I was hiding, you know, I wasn't even writing about it. I was, you know, hiding behind that mask of wanting to be a cool singer of a band, you know what I mean? And that's what I thought I had to be, and not to show weakness or anything like that. You know, and after everything I went through, you know, I started talking about it, and everyone I talked to about it, you know, whether it would be a friend or someone I just met, or has always been like, have you ever just said all of this, like in a row, like in a story to anyone? And I'm like, no, not other than this time, or not other than right now. And then I met a guy, his name is Mike Smith. He's only about a year older than me, but he's one of the biggest youth speakers in America. Yeah. But he's rad. He's a skateboarder. He's covered in tattoos. He's just a normal dude. That's doing some pretty incredible stuff. And, my friend Josh invited me to speak at this kind of like leadership retreat in Colorado, and I was like, you know, what am I gonna bring to the table? I'm just like a punk rock loser kid who like really is just trying to be a better person at this point. And you know, Josh was like, just tell your story. And so when we came to do the thing, it was cool because there was like you know, it was hosted by this company called Ruckus Apparel, which I know like you're familiar with. Because they had like all sorts of like skaters and just regular dudes and like music guys, tattooed guys, business guys, like all sorts of people meeting up with this like kind of weird collection of human beings that we really weren't sure what it was at the time. But it ended up being something cool that we do every year now. And he's like, yeah, so Mike's going to speak Friday night and you're going to speak Saturday morning. And I was like, oh, good. I get to speak after the professional speaker. That's really awesome. I'm looking forward to that. And then I kind of just ripped into my story and you know, kind of set it all organized. And Mike came up to me afterwards and just, you know, started filling me in about, you know, like he's, you know, that story really touched him and it moved him. And he thought that people need to hear it. And sure, most importantly, kids in high schools need to hear it. And I was like, I don't know if I want to go to high schools and talk, you know what I mean? That's, you know, for me it's a little strange, but then, you know, he made me realize it. Like, he's like, you grew up in punk rock, right? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, and kind of all the stuff you got from like, you know, all the values you really have in your life, you kind of gain from punk rock and from being in the music industry and, you know, that loving, caring, nurturing kind of like relationships you had. And he's like, now imagine all the kids that never will go to a punk rock show. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I guess it became my job to kind of bring a punk rock show to kids that would never get to go to one.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting point. Yeah, I always think about that. Like I'll find myself in like a club or something, which has happened like only on, you know, fingers on one of my hands. That I've ended up like in a fucking club. It's the worst place ever. But I see these people and they're like standing around and I'm like, oh my God, this is so boring. Like, and then I'm like, oh yeah, these are just people that never found punk rock.
Yeah, exactly.
all it is. They're just like, oh.
Punk rock didn't save their life yet.
No. And probably never will. And that's why there's a lot of shitty people in the world because they never found punk rock. Is that true? Can I say that? I'm just saying
I think
it.
So.
Whatever.
I'm saying it. I back that statement.
But yeah, man. So.
When it comes down to like the money aspect of it, the big thing that a lot of these guys that I've met and come a long way with has been like, Mike's good point was, you know, he's like, what do you do for a career? And I had to think about it because I used to teach, you know, years ago. I taught preschool and I've always worked with kids, which obviously everybody knows is not a very high paying job anyways. You do it because you love it and you want to make a difference.
Right.
And I had to think about it for a second and I was like, you know, for the last, you know, whatever, 8 years, you know, Vanna has been my career. It's been everything I've done. I put every worth into it. And, you know, he made the point of, don't you think it's time for you to like be able to take care of your family and take care of yourself and stop living on, you know, couches and stop, you know, couch surfing your friends' houses. And also, isn't it time for you to have something in your life? What better way to have something for your life than to talk about your life? And, you know, I kind of,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
It,
and I'm not,
came
and I'm
around
not,
to me
don't,
that way.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to like say,
no, I'm glad you asked.
No, because
a lot of times people don't understand it.
Well, people don't understand the other thing too, that like people expect musicians too, like a band like Vanna, who you know, you guys are I would say you're kind of like a mid-level artist where you're able to tour pretty consistently, you're able to get tours, you're able to do it, but you know, you aren't headlining House of Blues or anything, like, you know,
no,
what I mean?
Yeah,
you're
not
at that level.
We're not pulling down these like royalties or these merch sales that are insane to like just
exactly
live, you know?
So it's very, very you guys are really out there hustling. And, you know, and that's kind of how I'm sure you've lived your life. Yeah, you say you lived your life like that for 8 years. Now, bringing that into schools, it's a kind of a weirder environment for that. You know what I mean? But at the same time, your message going over, there is value to that, and it is your time, and I totally get it. But I just like, I just kind of wondered how that was initially, and now how it works out, and it's like. Some like you're like some schools like we can only give you this much money and you're like sorry I can't do it save these kids
sorry man not coming through it's cool we work with all sorts of budgets we work with all sorts of locations I'm even trying to get overseas now I've got a couple interests in like UK and Germany, and even for that like for mostly it's the travel. If you can get me there I'll just come and do it. And the cool thing is I've seen a lot, which it kind of, you know, I'm sure we'll touch on this a little bit, but people think teenagers nowadays suck. And in some respects, I can see why you might think that. But a lot of these kids, when they want me to come to their schools, they found me organically. They've brought it to their teachers, and their teachers go, okay, you have to figure out. And they crowdfund, and they come up with the money themselves. They do fundraisers, car washes. They take a couple Saturdays out of their week because they think that this is something their school needs to hear.
Wow,
and
awesome.
They raise a little bit of money. Yeah, and so whenever I can get with a student and talk to them about how we can figure it out, you know, I do free schools all the time. I work out with, you know, whatever schools can do. You know, sometimes what we do is like, if you want to do a couple of the smaller schools in the area, all you got to do is like go to one of their larger schools that have a big budget for it and offer your services to them. So that way you can go, they can cover costs, and then you can bang out to all these smaller schools that really need you to come in and do it but just can't afford it. So we work with all sorts of stuff, man.
Now, do you do this stuff typically? How long have you been doing this, first of all?
I've been speaking for 3 years at schools.
That's crazy that long. And do you typically, when you do it, do you get in a van and do it like it's a tour?
Dude, that's actually the next phase of something I want to concentrate. So normally what I do is, it depends. Like sometimes I'll do like, you know, tours where, you know, in the world of my agency, they're just booking me at a bunch of schools. But in my head, you know, I'm going, oh, I'm going to be in Southern California, Northern California, then Oregon, then Seattle. That's like a whole tour. So I'll make my own flyers for it. And sometimes it's like open to the public, so like people can just come to it. And I always have all my friends from the road. They always like, I've had more of my like heavily tattooed punk rock friends in high schools in the last couple years than, you know, any other time. But my next thing is I really want to take it on the road and do it in like clubs, like at night, you know what I mean? And possibly bring my guitar player, or, you know, go out with a couple other people like that. Like, cause there's definitely a couple other, you know, dudes in the music industry that like are speaking in one way or another, not really at high schools like I'm doing, but like in one way or another, you know, like my dream would be to like, you know, get in a van. My ultimate dream would be to get in a van with like Henry Rollins and Toby Morse and then me and do like a 3-part speaking thing. You know what I mean? So I think that's the next step for me, is going out in clubs. Cause a lot of what I'm getting from, you know, people who pay attention is that, when I do these public ones, it's all people of all ages, and people that aren't in high school anymore can come to these things. And, you know, I've kind of put the vibe out about doing like a story, like a storyteller's acoustic, but then also like speaking tour. And it seems like it's got some interest. So I think that's like my next step in 2017 is, I'm going to start doing like actual van tours, like getting in a van and going.
No,
out
I just, my question was basically just like logistically, when you go to these high schools, like, do you fly? Do you drive between?
Yeah, I just fly in. Oh, I just fly in. I'll rent a car, and then if some of them are like close, I'll just bang them all out real quick. Or I'll do, I mean, sometimes in 1 week I'm taking, you know, up to, you know, 4 to 8 flights a week, depending on where I have to be. Sometimes I have to be California, and then I have to be back in New Jersey, and then in Michigan, and then back home again. Like, it kind of bounces around.
That's crazy. Yeah, no, it's really cool. And it's funny that you mentioned the thing about the guy, you know, with the nice suit in high school. And actually, when I was in high school, I remember, we had, you know, probably like at least once a year, we had, you know, we're all getting in the gym and we're listening to someone speaking at least once a year, maybe twice a year. And there's two people that I remember listening to that really stood out. And the first was this ex drug addict guy who was really rough around the edges. And, you know, he was basically just like told his story of losing everything.
Yeah.
You know, that definitely scared me straight. You know, I was never gonna try heroin after that guy. You know,
sure.
So you know, that definitely put an impact on me. But this guy, and you should actually look into this guy. And I'm not sure what he's doing now, because he would be a bit older. But His name is George Shavallo, and he's a former a heavyweight boxer.
Yeah.
He's Canadian, and he's actually, I believe he's the only boxer ever to knock down Muhammad Ali.
Oh, wow.
I think, yeah. So he came to our school to speak, and I just thought it was going to be like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm a champion boxer. I'm going to tell my story of how I, you know, whatever, something bad happened to me. I got in a car accident or something. Like, you know, something like,
yeah, yeah.
And man, his story was really, really dark about his children. I think both of his sons developing heroin addictions, and
jeez.
I think maybe both of them even overdosing. I'm not sure. I don't remember all the details of the story, but that guy being there, that was like the most emotional thing I've ever heard. I still think about it.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the thing, is that like, that's what you make a connection to as a human, is listening to these other humans speak about whether it's a tragedy or success or, you know, triumphs or whatever it may be. You're listening to these people and the stories that like come out of, you know, what they're telling you, and they're standing in front of you, and you know, they're alive, and you know, they're making it. And, sometimes it's not even that person's in story. It's a story they tell about somebody else. That's the thing that hits you. It's whatever makes an impact on you. No one wants to sit there and be lectured for an hour about how to, like, you know, be successful and make your first million by 21. Like, yeah, that's great and all, but like, what is that really like? How are you really making a connection to any of these kids?
Right,
and like,
of course.
You remember that story, you know, what, almost 20 years later, you know?
Yeah.
And it stays with you. And that's kind of like, that's the main thing I try to do at these schools, is I tell my story from literally from birth to now, in hopes that something will connect with them and stay with them. And maybe it'll change something about their path that they don't have to go down the same way I did, you know?
Absolutely. And I think it's really, really rad. So a lot of people listening probably don't know your story, unless in the intro I tell your story. I don't know if that's kind of the thing I want to do or not. So basically, I just want to get to the beginning of like kind of what led you here now, being the front man of Vanna, you know, being going around America, talking to kids, and now, you know, even trying to take this overseas. Now, obviously, you have a really, really intense story, starting from basically from when you were born. And that's crazy, man. And I don't want to put like tell the story right now to put words in your mouth, but at the same time, like, I don't even know where to begin. So like, basically you were found in a drawer after a drug raid. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. That's like kind of where it all started. I was found in a drawer after a drug raid by my, like, from my paternal parents.
And you were about 8 months old.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I was, you know, found by, police, and then, they call me, like, you know, the miracle baby, because I wasn't supposed to, you know, survive something like that. And
like, this was in this must have been in the news and everything.
Yeah, yeah. There's like clippings and stuff about it from Boston, South Boston, whatever hospitals I ended up landing at. But I got put into you know, like, foster care. And this
did
is
you
like
have, a, sorry. This is I have to ask all these questions. Like, did you have a name? Like, is your name your name, or is your name?
Yeah, I had a different name. I had a different name completely. And it's funny, because when I was a little kid, I was always afraid to tell people that, because
of course
we didn't know if like my paternal parents named me that, because it's a very specific, very like weird name. So we weren't sure if they named me that to like come find me one day or something. You know, like, there's so many things that run through your head as a kid that is like adopted, about like the life that you don't know. You know, when we do like, you know, why do you have brown hair? Why do you have blue hair in school? And like, what are your parents like? Like, for me, that was like a point where like, I was like, I don't know. All I know about them was that they were like kind of bad drug dealers and they went to jail and now I'm here. So like, I don't, you know, there's like so many like questions you ask yourself.
How old were you when you found out like this whole story?
It's something I've known for like a really long time. So like, ever since I can remember, my parents, and whenever I say my parents, I refer to my, you know, my parents. And also my parents' parental situation is also very strange. I have a lot of parents. They've always told me since like day one, I always kind of knew like I was adopted from a, a family of drug users and drug dealers. And, my mother adopted me when I was, the adoption was finalized right before I was like 2 years old. And I've kind of always known this. I've always known both me and my sister are adopted from different families. I never felt, it's weird because I never felt disconnected from my mom's the one who raised me. My parents ended up getting divorced when I was four. So my mother is, basically a single parent raising me. And I've never felt, not connected to her. Like things I do now, like today, I'm like, that's my mom. I'm my mom. You know what I mean?
Sure.
We even kind of look alike. So it was really like kind of like strange for people to find out that, no, actually he's adopted. You deal with the classic, when your friends decide to turn on you in fifth grade and be mean to you and they use that against you, you know what I mean? Like, I dealt with a little bit. You don't even know who your parents are and, all this other stuff. Yeah. And I went through a little bit of counseling when I was younger too, because not only, was I adopted, my parents were divorced. My sister, was a little bit older than me and had some, developmental, issues with our school systems and stuff. So it's kind of like my family were sort of like the black sheep, even of our own family. My mother was the only one with adopted kids and that were divorced in our entire like extended family, So, right. We kind of grew up like that. But I think the one thing that it did for me is always made me more in touch with my mom. Like me and my mom was like my best friend growing up. So, I always said I wanted to be my mom and marry my mom when I grew up. Like that's, that was like, So for her, she found solace in music a lot. She had records all over the house at all times. She was a beautiful singer. We have like vinyls of her singing from like way back when she was like 18. So I kind of grew up around it. And, I grew up around the like, my house was a split house. It was like my mother was a former hippie, like rocker chick, but definitely like, found Jesus and was, religious too. So it was like we towed the line of like, gospel music and just, like worship music at our house, but then also like Black Sabbath and like
yeah, kind of going the other way there,
the Doors and Led Zeppelin, so I kind of grew up with this like huge musical influence. And I led me on to like obviously discovering stuff my own,
When you were in school, you said like, when you're in fifth grade and kids are being mean to you or whatever, like what kind of student were you? Were you a good student? Did you not really care about school?
I wasn't a good student, but I was a good kid,
Okay.
I think it was more of like, every report card I had growing up was like, never shuts up, too much socializing, never sits down, which is now my business cards that I give out. It just says my name, and on the other side, it just says never shuts up. Cause that's kind of like, I kind of got the last laugh with that. And all I do is with my whole entire life and career is with my mouth. So yeah. ha ha to all those teachers. But I was a likable kid, I also had, teachers telling my mom, like, he doesn't do his homework. He doesn't sit still in class, but he smiles at you and suddenly you forget everything. And I think he's going to get through the rest of his life with that smile.
Just using that charisma. And somehow it's totally worked out for you. And they knew at an early age. That's interesting though. I mean, there is a certain level of that. Like, my best friend in the world, his name's Chris. He's a great musician, first of all. An amazing musician, way better musician than I am, for sure. And it just never panned out for him,
Right.
It never panned out for him. He had bands and they were good. And, there's just kind of unlucky break after unlucky break. But he's one of those people, like, you just know he's going to figure it out. There's just people you meet, and he doesn't have a degree. He doesn't have education, but now he owns his own business. And he's super, super successful and he's super, super happy. And you know what I mean? He's got more money than I'll ever make. And,
exactly.
And he's figured it out and he's truly, content. And there's so much to it, like I'm sure you're not telling kids you talk to, you got to follow this path where you have to do this by this age and this by this age. It's like, fuck that.
Seriously.
But but the amazing thing is there's people that you just know are going to be successful. And I think your teachers recognize that you were one of those people.
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, they just kind of knew that, like, the a 9-to-5 behind a desk with a guy telling me what to do wasn't going to be in my future.
Yeah.
So why plan for it now, you know?
And that's okay. And that's okay.
I mean, 100%.
So later in your life, let's talk about how you transitioned from listening to your mom singing on records, which is really actually really cool, and listening to gospel music / Black Sabbath. And started, you know, wanting to perform your own music. You started as a drummer, right?
Yeah, I started out as a drummer. I mean, honestly, to be fair, exactly what it was, and this is, like, I guess, proof positive of our generation. Honestly, it was Warped Tour.
Cool. That's cool.
You know, like,
Well, the Boston Warped Tour is, like, kind of a special thing.
One of the biggest of the entire tour every year, you know?
Yeah.
And coming from Boston, there was a great music scene, but I didn't really know about that yet. I just love skateboarding, and I skated with this older dude that definitely shouldn't be hanging out with, like, middle school, high school kids. He was, like, definitely 30 and a creep, but
okay.
He was cool. He drove a limo and wore a leather jacket, so I thought that was pretty cool. And he told us about Warped Tour and was like, you know, I'll bring you guys to Warped. Like, you can skateboard and you can, you know, watch bands. So I went to Warped Tour and...
what year was this?
98. I want to say 98 or 99.
Yeah.
And I went and Green Day played that year.
Oh, that was 2000.
Was that 2000?
Yeah, I'm like a Warped Tour encyclopedia. Don't mind
me. Okay. so it was like my freshman year of high school, I think. And I was already playing like drums in a band then, but like I only knew like, you know, a handful of bands, like Christian punk bands at that time. Like I'd gone from like, you know, that world to over the Christian punk world. And I went to Warped Tour and just my mind was blown by like, you know, because I came from a small town outside of Boston. My mom was just blown about everything. And I literally went home and was like, I told my mother, I was like, I have to be like in a band. Like, there's no way, like, this is exactly what I have to do. And I was putzing around on the drums with some friends, but what I want to do is play guitar and sing in a band. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that's what everyone wants to do. And you know, I got the harsh reality from my mom. She was like, you know, we don't have a lot of money for guitars. Like, I don't know where you're going to get a guitar from. And she, you know, broke it to me that I couldn't sing, you know, when I was so 13 year old me standing in front of her with my voice cracking, being like, I can sing. And, so I dove into drums. And it's funny because I had no one to teach me, drums. And I approached this guy at my church named Bob. And that was when I was 15 years old and I'm 32 and he's still my stepfather. My parents, they got married through me getting drum lessons from this guy.
That's wild.
They met, they clicked, and they've been married for what, 17 years or something like that. So
that's
rad. Music became the forefront of my entire life. Not only do I have like a rad singer mom who lets me listen to cool music, but now I have like my stepfather's a drummer, you know, and you know, he started introducing me to all sorts of like different types of, you know, more and more music and,
sure.
You know, eventually just playing in bands and then, you know, playing like in my basement and, you know, friends' basements. And then eventually being like, I got to do more than this. I know that bands don't stay in a basement or a garage. We got to do something. And, you know, I grew up outside of Boston. So like I knew about shows, but it was impossible for me to get to show or play one, you know, and even with my own band. So, I kind of went back to the drawing board and was like, well, the only place I know that I can probably do a show is school.
Yeah.
So I had to turn back inside and go, okay, well, I guess I have to care about school now, which sucks because I don't care about school. And like kind of what you were saying about teachers recognizing something in you, I had a teacher, an English teacher, that kind of was helping me with my writing and helping me realize the connection between like, hey, idiot, like English and writing. I mean, and music goes like hand in hand, poetry.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
all these,
sure.
Like,
sure.
But he's the first one to get me to realize that a subject in school could be about something I like, you know? And so he helped me get, you know, he helped me get us a place for us to have shows, which was the cafeteria of my school, but not before I had to like, you know, I had to raise my grades and like start paying attention. And like, I became like the, you know, with all my friends, I became the like, you know, the nerd loser that had to like pay attention in class because he actually wanted to do something else besides just sit there. You know, like I like wanted to do shows. And if I wanted to do shows, my teachers had to kind of take me seriously. So, you know, I kind of had to like raise my grades a little bit. And it wasn't, I never was because I was like dumb, you know what I mean? Like I'm a pretty smart human being. I just was bored and I didn't care.
Of course. Yeah. And that's a story that's common, you know?
Yeah. I think that's a classic thing with Absolutely. Like a lot of us, you know what I mean? It's yeah. like, we're just bored and this didn't interest us. So it kind of went from that to like, you know, me becoming the guy that brought, you know, the shows to my high school. And, you know, of course we did all, you know, it was acoustic guys, rappers, rock bands, punk bands. My band would definitely headline every single time because we were the sickest band ever. So as I sip my coffee. Yeah. I mean, so like, that's kind of how, you know, it manifested in me that I was like, I can't do anything else.
So the sick band you were in high school, what were you called?
It was called, I was in a couple bands. So I became the drummer of like a few bands cause I wanted to be in a bunch. So I was in a band called Kung Fu Master, which was like a pop punk ish band. Pop punk before pop punk was pop punk, you know, like when those bands just existed. And I was in a band, I was in a rap metal band called Ascension.
Ascension.
Yeah, dude.
There was actually like a real, sorry, no offense about real band, but there was a real band called Ascension that was pretty good too. I think they were, where's Ascension from? I can't remember where they're from. They're like a metal, they were a metalcore band before it was called metalcore.
Metalcore, right, yeah. Yeah, totally.
same thing, you know?
Yeah. We were only a rapcore band because one of my best friends had no musical talent whatsoever until he discovered he could scream in a hardcore band a couple years later.
Oh yeah.
And but he had like DJ equipment, so we just let him be in the band. I don't really know like how much DJing he actually did, but he was just like in the band, I guess, you know.
Yeah. So okay, so I know that there was one band, I should have the name in front of me. Secret Destroyer. That was
yes.
kind of your main band yeah. that kind of led you towards Vanna, right?
Yeah, yeah. That was like the band that I kind of like was like, you know, doing serious touring in. I mean, serious as you can be DIY touring.
Now, did that form after high school, or was that?
Yeah, that was kind of a product of like I graduated high school and I was with a girl who ended up cheating on me and having a baby with somebody else. So it kind of threw my whole like after high school plans into like the stratosphere and didn't really know what I was gonna do. It was kind of like a rough situation. So I kind of like, hit reset in my life and was like, I'm going to go back to music and like try to pursue music. It was one of the first bands that like, gave me a purpose in life. Cause at that point, after like that girl and multiple things that happened in my life, I kind of just hit like rock bottom. I hit like the suppression and, Seeker, you know, I joined one band. We had some member changes that led to, you know, eventually getting to like, you know, getting to Seeker, which is, before Vanna. And, it was the first band. It was the first time that like, instead of just doing music for fun, I was literally depending on it to like be alive. You know what I mean? It was the first band that I was like, you know, battling through, you know, being so sad. And the only time I ever was happy is when I was on stage with that band, you know?
Okay. So basically you went through this thing with this girl cheating on you, having a baby with someone else. I understand you even raised the child for a little while.
Yeah, I did. I raised it for a little while. It had my mother's, you know, like middle name, like the whole thing, the whole yeah. like, okay, this is my life now. And I'm ready for it.
How did you find out?
There was like lots of lies going on because, first of all, she was, pregnant with this baby. And I didn't know until her friend called me to tell me she was in labor with a child.
Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, that's
sketchy right off the bat then.
Yeah. Right, first red flag. There you go. Over a little bit of time, things were getting weird. And my mom, to anyone listening that may be younger than me, moms usually know exactly what's going on. So listen to them. my mom had a feeling like this was sort of something that was a sketchy deal. And she told me that she said, you know, I know you don't want to, but you should ask if there's a chance the baby's not yours. Like, you know, I can't think of what else this is stemming from. And I asked her and her response was, I don't want to talk about this right now, and hung up the phone on me.
That's a red flag number two. Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, so I kind of found out in a harsh way, and then the testing and all that, whatever, you know. A few months later, it came back that it wasn't. So, the Seeker was the first band that I was like, all right, I'm diving in, you know, head first into this, you know, this music, this world, you know. And you know, I, even though I was battling a depression then, and even a suicide, like, you know, attempt during that ban, it was really the only thing that, like, ever, you know, kept me afloat and kept me going. And I didn't realize it at the time. You know, I thought I was just, you know, there's no point to anything anyways. But it led to bigger things. I worked really, really hard in that band. You know, when I talk to younger bands now and I tell them stories of how I got Seeker touring, it's hilarious because they just don't even understand it. I went on MySpace. I did like that show router thing. I posed as my own booking agent and made up fake emails.
Oh, like, sure. Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like, anything to just get your band out there. We play for, like, you know, nobody. We play for $50. We play for Gap, you know, whatever, you know. Canada was actually awesome for us because we live in the Northeast. So we would shoot up to Canada and go, you know, from all the way from Quebec City to like Toronto and like the surrounding areas, like the GTA, and then come back again. And like, that's how we started learning how to tour, how to be in a band, how to do it, how to grind. And
I love that you just said the GTA.
Yeah, dude.
Damn,
I got big love for Canada. My wife's Canadian, so I'm like, I'm pretty much half Canadian.
I didn't know your wife's Canadian. Where's your wife from?
Ottawa.
Oh, crazy. Mm-hmm. Crazy. That's wild.
I was just there.
The GTA, it stands for Greater Toronto Area, but I don't think people outside of Canada typically use that term. Like, if you were to, you know,
yeah,
what I mean?
I think of like Grand Theft Auto, like if yeah, I say GTA. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. That's, yeah. I never even thought of the connection. Obviously, I know. Yeah. That's funny.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
That's cool. How did you get across the border for those shows?
We lied a whole lot. Yeah. We said that the old thing to get into Canada was say that you are recording in Canada and that all your merch, you're doing promotional like nights at clubs and giving away to promote the record.
Yeah.
And that worked for years until, like, even up until Vanna, and I tried it in Vanna and they were like, that's not what you say anymore. And we were like, okay.
That's okay. Not what you say anymore. Like, they just knew and they were like,
they
whatever.
They just knew. They're just like, that's BS, dude. We're not doing that. Turn around, get out of here.
That's really funny, man. That's cool. So, okay. Yeah. So you guys had, like, I guess your touring band, you had a little bit of success, but you never had like any label interest or anything.
Yeah, we had a little. There was this label that I'd worked with called Hotfoot Records, just a little tiny indie label out of Long Island, and I was putting stuff, like, you know, I was like figuring it out, like how do I get my songs on iTunes? Oh, okay, that's how you do it. How do you get your shit on like Pure Volume? Like, I just was figuring it out, like, as I went along. And it's funny because looking back, I thought I had a pretty good handle on what the music industry was, and I literally knew nothing. Like, you don't know anything, man. But I was trying to learn.
I still feel like I know nothing, dude.
Yeah, exactly. Every day, I still feel every day that I'm challenged and I don't know what I'm talking about. But yeah, and that kind of led to we did bigger tours. Bands started to like us. We were like a band's band for sure, you know.
Yep.
And then we just started doing stuff. We did stuff with like We Came as Romans. We did stuff with like Motionless and White. And back in the day, it was just less saturated, so like it was, I mean, easier to kind of do stuff.
Sure.
And then Vanna asked us to do their like CD release tour for a record called The New Hope. And man, that was like huge because Vanna was like, you know, they were like kingpins at home. And it wasn't always like that. When Vanna first started, they got signed off of, it was when record labels start figuring out that the internet was like a viable place to find things. And sure. Epitaph signed Vanna and Escape the Fate off of Pure Volume because they were like Pure picks 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
And so they got a little guff at home for it. Like, people were kind of being like, oh, this band's brand new and they've only played a few shows.
Right.
Like, screw these guys.
There's the whole paying the dues thing, which used to be important. It's still important in my opinion. And I think bands need to, you know,
Well, you know, you can tell when a band's brand new to something and they haven't done, like, you know, multiple tours.
Absolutely.
You
know? But it's funny, though, that you say that. Like, even Panic at the Disco was, like, signed before I think they ever played a show.
Show ever, yeah.
You know, and that was, they were, like, maybe the first band I'd ever heard of like that. And I don't know when that was. That was, like, probably 2004 or something. But I actually have a funny story about Falling in Reverse when they got signed. So I was in Las Vegas, House of Blues. We were playing with Hawthorne Heights, and I came in the dressing room, you know, in the afternoon, brought my bag into the dressing room at the House of Blues backstage, and there's this, like, weird dude in the room, and I don't know who he is. He's, like, you know, long hair, leather jacket, he's got, like, a Discman, I think. Yeah, it was a Discman. It wasn't even an MP, like, an iPod. It was a Discman, and he's like, dude, you gotta check out my band. We're so sick. And I was like, and he literally put the headphones on my head and played this CD. And I'm thinking, like, I just woke up, like, what is going on? Second of all, I'm like, who's this weird dude? Why is he in here? Third of all, I'm like, this is actually pretty good. This is, like, way better than any, like, demo I've heard in a while. And that was Ronnie Radke with with Escape the Fate. Did I say Falling in Reverse before? I meant Escape the Fate.
Yeah,
that was him. That's the first time I ever met him, was in a That's dressing hilarious. Room forcing me to listen to his band.
That sounds about right.
Sorry, a little side note there.
I love that.
I've got to take a quick break to talk about our sponsor, Loot Crate, but I'll be right back with the rest of my conversation with Davey. So if you've been listening to the show for the last couple months, you know our main sponsor is Loot Crate. Loot Crate is so awesome. Such a cool concept. Basically, how it works, you sign up, and every month they send you a box full of really cool stuff. And they've been really awesome to me. They've really been helping out the show, and they've been sending me all this cool stuff in the mail. And as you guys know, I'm a nerd. I like a lot of geeky stuff. I'm into retro video games. I'm into cult movies. I'm always quoting them. I read graphic novels, and this month they have a really cool theme. It's Origins, so basically they're going back to, you know, the real classics. So basically, if you're on a quest for epic gear, housewares, and collectibles, Loot Crate brings you between 4 and 6 of the coolest curated mystery items every month straight to your doorstep. It's the best surprise that you know is coming. Our next crate's theme is Origins. We have awesome and exclusive items from your old school favorites. This January, see where it all started and explore the iconic origins with historic items featuring Superman, Captain America, Mario, I love Mario, and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And, of course, always including our monthly t-shirt and pin. Here's the deal. Here's how it works every month. You have until the 19th, January 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive this month's crate. But when that cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. So make sure you sign up by the 19th. I'd sign up now. Just go do it now. It's great. So make sure you head over to lootcrate.com/leadsinger and enter the promo code leadsinger, and you're going to save $3 a month off your subscriptions. So again, it's lootcrate.com/leadsinger, promo code leadsinger. I've really been enjoying it. So if you're anything like me, I know you will too. You know, obviously, we're leading to the story of how you ended up in Vanna, which is awesome. But like when you decided to jump ship, from a band that you'd basically built yourself to a band that was already established, how was that? That must have been a difficult decision for you.
Yeah,
am I wrong, or was it just like, oh shit, they're huge, I love their band, I'm in?
Dude, no, it was really tough. Actually, I said no at first. They approached me on that tour that we did with them because their singer was leaving and said they needed a singer. And, you know, for me in my head, you know, I built up Seeker to be, you know, something really awesome. And it was special. It was special. And for me, I wanted Seeker to be that. I said no at first. And then slowly, you know, I said no, but I'd help them find somebody. And I helped them, you know, find a couple people to try out. And, you know, obviously having to keep that information quiet was a little bit, like, you know, difficult to do. But like, I, over time, I was just realizing my band, after we did a couple tours, we got into a fist fight in the studio, like a bunch of stuff. I was realizing that I was the only one really doing anything besides my drummer. He was like the only guy, like he was helping out so much, but it was me and him carrying the ship. And like, we were like in our early 20s, just broke, working any jobs we can. And, you know, it pained me to see him, you know, paying out his ass and me doing the same thing for tours and all stuff. And, you know, I got my license taken away because these guys were being negligent with the van and a bunch of stuff. Oh, and geez. I realized it was like, it was a really bad relationship with a girl that, like, we were just together for too long and we hated each other, but the sex was really, really good. And that's why we stayed together. Like, playing with Seeker was something that was like undeniable. And I kind of put that vibe out to a couple of people in my area that Vanna had asked me to join. And then during our shows after I said no, a couple people were like, how could you ever let this go? This is so special. This is so special. And what I was realizing is Seeker was a special thing for not only myself and the guys in the band, but it's a special thing for the like kids in our scene, in our area in New Hampshire, that this was all kind of taking place in New Hampshire, Massachusetts. And it was special, and it was, but it wasn't being special to me. All the specialness was being ripped out by all the business that was just terrible, and it was resting on my shoulders. And I realized that, you know, it was special because it was special to everybody else. And I needed, it needed to be time for me to take control, and I needed happiness in my life, and I wasn't getting it, but I didn't want to give up on music. So I kind of looked at it as like, I reconsidered and I called the guys back up and I was like, is that spot still available? And of course, you know, he's like, yeah, we do, but you know, here's who wants to try out, you know, like Chris Roeder wanted to try out of like, you know, like Massa Flans. We joke about it all the time. When I see him, and like John Blake from On Broken Wings, and like lots of different like people from different bands. I was like, crap, now I have competition. I'm just Davey from Seeker. I'm nobody, you know?
So I guess you'd learn to sing at this point.
Yeah.
Your mom wasn't like, dude, you can't sing.
Dude, you can't sing. And like, I can sing a little bit. I can definitely scream. I can sing a little bit. And you know, my wish was to, and I was even having my mom in mind of like, you know what, how stoked would my mom be if I could like, you know, cause the Vanna could sell out downstairs Palladium, you know, how stoked would I be to look to my right and see my mom sitting there watching that? Sure. Like, you know what I mean? Like it was time.
When you joined the band, was there like any talk of changing the name? Cause it was, you know what I mean? Like having a new singer at that point, I think there's only maybe one or two original members. Was there any talk of that, or how did you feel about that?
You know, there wasn't, and kind of how I came into it was I'd been friends with these guys for years before this, and I felt like, to me, and still this remains to this day, I feel like Vanna's more than just the band. It's always been about, Vanna's always been about their friends, their loved ones, the bands around them, the kids around them. Vanna's never been just about Vanna. So Vanna's more than the five people that are in the band. Right. It's sort of an idea. And I know it kind of sounds like convenient and kind of hippy dippy and stupid and weird, but it's kind of true. That's the environment. When I started going to Vanna shows, when they first started playing, that's kind of the environment they cultivated, whether they wanted to or not. They were just about, you were always going to feel good at a Vanna show. You were always going to have a good time. You know what I mean? And so when that came into it, I just thought I wanted to continue that work that we did, you know. Years later, and another, you know, two members change. I don't feel like that spirit has ever changed. It's been the same. I think that people rely too much sometimes on the name of a band, because to be fair, like Vanna, like Silverstein, like you are Silverstein. You are what you make it. So like if I write a record if we write records that are completely out of our genre, well, it's still our band. This, we say it is what it is. You know what I mean? So, I just told the guys, I just want to embody the spirit that band kind of had, you know what I mean? And Vanna's a weird name. It kind of sticks in your head, cause it's not something that's like, I don't know, predictable or whatever. So I kind of dug it. So, we got flack from a lot, people, when I joined, you know, saying,
oh yeah.
You know, right away, they didn't even hear me yet, you know? And I think, and they're like, oh, this guy sucks. And I'm like,
that's my next question. Like that, I've talked to other lead singers, you know, that have joined bands, even some that like, look at like someone like Corey from Norma Jean.
Yeah.
Like he had to come in, you know, with like replacing Josh. Like like that's insane, you know, like
one of the best front men of our genre,
right? You know what I mean? Like there's people like that where you're just like, that guy had to deal with it. No matter how good you are, you're gonna have to deal with that bullshit. And but is it true? I read this somewhere, but is it true that like when you joined the band, you were introduced, but the other guy was still there, and he like basically gave you a microphone handoff? Is that like?
Yeah, we so the way
that's
we did
a crazy
it was,
idea, and I don't know if that's like that must have been a lot of pressure like on you.
And to be fair, in like retrospect, like would I do it that way again? I don't know, maybe not. I don't know. It was an idea we had because the band was like, all right, come on tour, do merch for us, and you know, pop in a song and see how you like it. And I was supposed to be on tour for a week, and I ended up joining. They asked me to stay on the whole tour, this month and a half tour, so I did it, and then we decided about 2 weeks into the tour that I was the guy. They called up their management. We sent them videos. We had a house party on a day off with the Hit the Lights guys in Lima, and we were partying, and they called me into a room, and they're all standing there, and they asked me to join the band. So then it became, okay, well, now we want Davey to do half the set. So during one of our songs, Trash Mouth, we'd hit like where I used to do guest vocals. Well, I would do guest vocals and finish the song with Chris, our old singer. And then Chris would announce every night, this is my last tour with the band. You know, yada, yada, yada. Here's Davey. He's going to perform. And I would then finish the set with them.
Well, the first day, like the first time you do that, I get it. Okay. You know,
yeah,
people are going to be weirded out anyways. But then, like, there's this thing called the internet, and, like, everyone's going to find out about it.
Well, we made an announcement. So the first day that he said, I'm not in the band, we did, like, a passing of the torch. We, like, posted a picture on Lambgoat of Chris handing me a lighter. I don't know. It's really stupid.
Yeah.
We announced it. And then it got to be like that. I was doing that, like, you know, every show, and it was Chris's. So then Chris started, like, just partying super hard, which was sick because he's just like, he was just going out in a blaze of glory and just like, you know, hey man, it's your driving shift, you're the guy now, you talk to the kids, you know, which is cool because we're still really good friends,
right?
Chris,
that's
so
like pretty cool because the whole, you know, again, I say this every episode, this is the Lead Singer Syndrome podcast, and part of having Lead Singer Syndrome is, this is my fucking band, I'm the only one that can do this job, you know what I mean? There's these cliche things where, like, who's this fucking guy, get him out of here, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
And to be honest, like, for him to put his ego aside, you know, and let you sing the songs that he put his heart and soul into. It's kind of wild, you know?
Yeah, it was a cool concept, and he was super down for it. And he was the one that, like, when he told the label and everybody of like, hey, I don't want to do this anymore, they were like, you know, who are we going to get? And he was like, why don't we get Davey? Like right off the bat, he said, why don't we get Davey? So it was kind of his idea from the beginning. And it was cool of him to share the stage with me. You know, we're still really, really good friends. We see him literally once a tour for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, we're still, it's funny because like I've been in the band now 8 years and I'm always like, you're going to come up and do a song with me tonight. And he's like, I literally can't scream. Like, no, I can't. I don't do anymore.
What's he doing now?
He's doing really well. He's moved back and forth. He was in the military for a while. He's moved kind of back and forth throughout the country, but he owns a green energy company. He just got married and he just had his first baby. So he's killing it in life right now.
Good for him.
And we're still in the van touring around the country and staying at his house.
That's funny. So you mentioned the label. The label said who we were going to get. Was that Epitaph?
That was Epitaph at the time.
Because you didn't ever do a record on Epitaph.
No.
What happened?
I came in the equation. We went to the Epitaph office, and I will say this, that like just being in the Epitaph office for me was just a dream come true because they have released some of my favorite records like all time. So of course I'm like, man, I'm on Epitaph Records. This is so cool. And it was, you know, I think that Epitaph, I mean, I don't think I know because we've had conversations about it, but they didn't really know what to do with the band, especially after I joined, you know. They released their second full length and critically didn't do super hot. even though the songs were great. It just didn't do so well. And I don't think Epitaph really knew what to do. A new singer halfway through a record cycle. Like, they just were kind of like, and it came to like, it had to be like me who realized it like later on. Cause in my band, I did everything. And when I joined Vanna, I was just like, I just kind of sat in the back seat and like waited for things to happen, twiddling my thumbs. And I finally spoke up and was like, listen, this pains me to say this because it's my dream, but I don't think we should be on Epitaph Records. I don't think they know what to do with us, and I don't think we know what to do with them. And we had a phone call with them, and they were so cool, and they were like, yeah, we honestly kind of really don't know what to do. And they had paid for us to go record that Honest Hearts EP, which was the first thing that I did in the band. And they paid for a video already, and they were just like, you know what? Take the record, take the video, shop it to where you think you should go, and like, we support you. And we're still really good friends with everyone over at Epitaph still to this
day.
That
is super cool. And I know Brett a little bit, you know, have had some rumblings. Actually, the first time I met Brett Gurewitz, he asked me for a picture.
He's a rad dude.
Yeah, he is a rad dude. I have a lot of respect for Epitaph. Yeah. And that's, you know, and I get it too, because they have your old records, they have your old catalog. So if you have success, then that's just going to get paid back to them in spades. And they're a cool punk rock label. So totally makes sense.
I think that's what it was that their like whole punk rock mentality. I was like, yo, man, I don't think we should be on your label because I don't want to waste your time. I don't think you really even want to spend the time on us. We need to figure out who we are so that we can figure out where to go. And they were like, hell yeah, man. You're like, fist pound. Here's your video. Here's your record. Free and clear. Go do you. And it was cool because I don't think anyone thought that that's how that was going to go down, but they were literally so cool. And, you know, they continue to just be a really cool punk rock label that gets it. And, you know, maybe I'll find myself with that label again one day. But, you know, they were great to let us go and let us kind of go find who we are and find ourselves, which that's kind of exactly what we did for the next few years.
Cool, man. Geez, we have been just talking and talking.
I can do that.
I know that. It's good. So now transitioning, you know, from you being the guy kind of sitting, you know, in the back, not saying anything, to now basically it seems like you're kind of the full on leader of the band. You're tour managing the band. You got to deal with all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like didn't you guys have like a bad van break in?
Yeah, that was actually recent. That was probably a year ago. We had a pretty bad van break in. Yeah, it stole all of our stuff, man.
Did you get anything back? Did you get your insurance?
Well, the way that the insurance worked was we were renting from Green Vans. Our guitar player works for Green Vans. So we naturally just take those, and we don't even own a van. And the way that insurance works, on that is you have insurance on the actual van. So like the window that was broken, that was covered under insurance.
Yeah.
But there's no personal, when you have a rental company, that rental company, there's no personal insurance. Now you can get like, if you rent a car from an agency, like, you know, whatever.
You can buy it extra.
You can buy it.
But no, like, it's usually through your homeowner's insurance if there's stuff in
it.
But then it's weird. But then it's complicated because if you're using the van for business purposes, then it's not covered.
Exactly.
So
since we file for taxes, you know, with this van, it fell into this weird category of sorry, no, nothing can be done, but we can fix the window. And that's just the reality of the scenario.
Yeah.
And we got, and you know, all the guys, all of us own a business or run a business, and we have to do that from the road. So, you know, all of our laptops and everything, and they found everything. Like they got in and they just dragged everything out from like underneath the seats. Even stuff that was locked up that I don't even know how they're going to manage to get into it. They stole everything that they could. So we were down like 5 laptops, a bunch of iPads. You know, my guitar player, Nick, who does graphic design, not only is he out his graphic design computer, but he was out all of his original scans of his work. So he had to, like, what he's doing right now is he's just drawing around the clock to rework all those designs again. Like, there's just stuff that we lost that we're never going to be able to get back. Some of us had cash in our bags. And it was awful because we parked in Atlanta and it was in this neighborhood that's like a super good neighborhood. And it was like well-lit street next to an Urban Outfitters, next to a theater, like very good neighborhood. And we met up with Stevis from the Chariot for dinner.
Good buddy of mine.
Yeah. And then Steve left us. And then we were like, all right, well, let's go back to the van and go to where the house we're staying at. And then we got back. And I mean, the van was so well lit. We could see the broken window from like so far away. We were like, what's wrong with that window? And as soon as we got up to it, I was like, oh my God, we got broken into. But you know, the cool thing was, not even 24 hours later, we raised enough money to be able to go buy all of our stuff back because we didn't know what to do. And my guys are sitting on the curb like, Mom, Nick has a son at home. And like naturally, his head starts going to thinking about, oh, I do graphic design to provide for my family. I don't have a computer. I'm done. You know, like and I'm looking at my dudes and I'm on the phone with our manager and I'm like, what do we do? And he's like, what do you always do in this band when something goes wrong or something's terrible? And I'm like, play a show. And he's like, you turn to your fans.
That's
and
right.
I was like, that's right. True, man.
Hey, you turn to music and music is your shovel. So
yeah, exactly. So we raised the money. We played a show, a sold out show the next night in South Carolina. And the crowd got together and bought us a hotel room. Like it was just, I've never felt more outpouring than, you know, from one community than that night. So it's like, it took something that could have been devastation. Like if bands we didn't have to raise money, we had to go home.
Bands break up over this shit.
Oh,
like,
dude,
people don't understand how devastating it is. You know, like not just in terms of financially for the band, but just personally going through that and the feeling of, you know, being robbed and being, you know, I don't know the word, you know, just someone coming into your life and doing that, you know, is,
yeah, man, it sucks.
It's devastating.
Dude.
So, you know, I'll tell you a funny story while we're to keep it a little lighter. This band, now, I mean, I've heard this story like third or fourth hand.
Right.
So if anyone listening to this, if I'm telling the story slightly wrong, but this is the way I heard the story. So this band, I think they're from North Carolina. They're called Scarlet. Metalcore band, maybe from 10 years ago.
Yep, I remember.
They had their entire van and trailer stolen. And basically they had, you know, they had no choice. They had to go home. They just couldn't figure it out to play any more shows or whatever. So they ended up going home and they're like talking about breaking up, you know, going through like the worst time of their lives. And they get some kind of tip to where their shit is. I don't know how they got a tip, but they got some kind of tip that their van or whatever was in South Carolina. So they go down to wherever this is, and they find this house, and it's in kind of this, like, from what I understand, like sort of a ghetto neighborhood where the houses are sort of far apart, and there's like, you know, kind of unkept lawns everywhere. And they go to this door and they look in the backyard, and sure enough, their trailer is in the backyard.
No.
And they're like, what the fuck? They knock on the door, and this old lady answers the door wearing a Scarlet shirt. Isn't that incredible?
I love that. That's very great.
Man, like, yeah, there's that one.
Insane.
And then another one I heard while I'm on the subject, another North Carolina band called Hope's Fall. Great band.
Yes. Yep.
They had all their gear stolen, I think, multiple times. But one time they went to, you know, after a show, they put out the sign at the merch, hey, does anybody have a place to stay? And they go to some kid's house. They go down into the basement. Oh, yeah, you guys are going to sleep down here. I got a little bit of gear down here. You know, I hope you don't mind. But if you guys want to jam, you know, I got this, like, cool drum kit. And it was the drummer's kit.
His like custom, previously gotten stolen.
Yeah, his custom drum set. So he knew it was his because it was like a custom like truth kit or something.
Oh my god!
Yeah, and he's like, "What the hell? Where did you get that kit?" And the kid's like, "Oh yeah, I bought it at a gas station out of the back of a truck for $250."
Good lord!
So yeah, man, it's crazy. Like, and I have no doubt that your stuff's, you know, it's out there.
Dude, it's some dude. This isn't even the first time. We recorded with Matt Goldman in Atlanta a few years ago, and our whole entire trailer got stolen. Whole thing.
Oh, man. And gone forever?
Gone forever. Never got anything. And we had just we had just before that tour, before that recording, started a tour and then had to leave the tour because of a death in the family. So we had 10 G's worth of like untouched merch just sitting in there that I definitely know whoever stole the trailer just threw it all out. We were like, dude, at least just leave with the merch so we could sell it. Like, that right. would be sick. I like to believe that somewhere in Atlanta is an FU Vanna warehouse where all of our stuff is just sitting in a warehouse, like, just so we don't get to do anything with our lives. Yep. I'm convinced of that.
Hey, you never know. Maybe something will pop up on eBay and you'll get a lead and you'll find out.
I hope something like that happens, that we just like go down to a basement and there all our stuff. Just
I know, right? That would be, that's good. Choice. That's good news. But
yeah,
no, I forget where it was. I was playing like a Gibson, like a really nice Gibson acoustic old one or something on tour. I was playing, and some guy in an older band, this is when I was younger, came up to me. I don't remember who it was. And he said, nice guitar. I said, oh, yeah, thanks. He goes, how much was that thing? I go, oh, you know, it's like this. He's like, yep. He's like, you obviously haven't had all your shit stolen yet. and he's playing like an Epiphone, you know, like $300 guitar on tour in a big band, because he's like, fuck that. I don't want, you know what I mean? Like,
I don't want my good stuff to be stolen.
Right. That has obviously sentimental value too. But
God.
Anyways, Davey, we have went on and on. This has been a great conversation. Would love to have you back for a part two.
I love it.
You know, you guys working on some new music? I know your new record is fairly new.
It's fairly new.
Or you got tours coming up? What's going on with you guys?
We've toured pretty heavily this year. We figured out that we were gone almost 9 months this entire year, which is crazy. It's been big for us. So right now we're at home enjoying holidays, enjoying family and wives and children and all that kind of stuff. And then we meet up in a couple weeks to start discussing like the future plans of stuff and future music and all that kind of stuff. I think that this year put a really big hold on Vanna personal life and like even like our business life and stuff. And we're taking this like brief moment of you know, time out to kind of collect ourselves and figure out what's next for us and what's not only next for Vanna, but what's next for like, you know, each one of us personally and stuff. So it's actually nice to just be able to like kind of sit here in my office and work on my nonprofit and work on stuff that, you know, I haven't gotten to be able to do in almost a year. So it's really nice.
No, that's great. And my final question, do you have any plans to write a book?
Yeah, that's a funny question. I got approached, by a publishing company from New York, but maybe probably in, I think February, of this year to sit down and write a book. And it's something I've always wanted to do. And I kind of have started compiling stuff and putting things together, for the kind of style I want to do it in. And, so many notebooks, I mean, as you probably do too, of just lyrics and diary entries that I'm starting to go through and sort of just kind of convert into stuff. So my end game, I guess, with all of it is to put out a book about my life.
I think it would be very, very interesting and very compelling and also help people, you know, and that's what you're trying to do now, which I can really respect.
Yeah, man, that's kind of all I'm living for now. It's just like, I just want to help people, you know, either, you know, kind of share with what I went through so you don't have to go through it, or kind of give you like a cliff notes. Like, all right, well, if you're going to be a D-bag and a loser, here's how you do it right. So
nice, man. Yeah. Nice, man. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It's great to have you.
No problem, man. Yeah, thank you for having me, man.
So there it was, my conversation with Davey of Vanna, such an inspiration, just an amazing guy. What he's doing talking to kids in schools is really, really cool. And, you know, I don't know if we're supposed to be role models as lead singers of bands. I don't know if I'm a role model. I don't think about that very often. I mean, I guess I try to set a good example just in generally in life. So I guess that's part of it. But taking it a step further and really just saying, hey, I'm going to go in and I'm going to be that role model. I'm going to do it. I'm going to try to make the world a better place, you know, one student at a time or 1,000 students at a time, probably, who he's speaking to, is a really amazing thing. So much love to Davey. Thank you, Davey, for doing it. All the best in 2017. And to all you guys, thank you so much again for listening to my show. The support has been great. If you're digging it, please go on iTunes, write a review, preferably 5 stars. Give me some love. Hit me up on email, whatever you got to do. And of course, spread the word. If you love the show, tell a friend, tell a loved one, and let's keep this thing growing. As always, I'm going to play a tune. Here's one of my favorite Vanna songs. This jam is called Digging. Enjoy, and peace and love. We'll see you next week.